This morning I sit in the office of Professor Ray Deal, Mount Union College. Ray is retiring this year as a professor in the Department of Economics and Business Administration. I want to talk with him about his experiences on the campus. He is unique both as a student here at the college and later as a member of the faculty. Ray, you didn't start off as a normal 18-year-old student. How did you happen to match up with Mount Union College when you did?
Well, my first experience with college was in 1928 when I went to Asbury College for one term and transferred to Mount Union. And through the processes that young people many times go through, I found myself a spouse that I thought an awful lot of, and we got married, and that ended my college at that time. Well, I learned the tool and die trade and was engaged as a tool and die maker when the Second World War broke out. And after the war was over, I felt that I needed to finish my education and do some things that I always wanted to do. Now, being a teacher anywhere was the last thing I ever thought of before I went to the service. When I was in the service, I was made an instructor in some of the technical areas of the Navy Air Force. And after I came out, I had the opportunity, of course, of going to school and finishing my education, and that's the way I happened to get into Mount Union.
Now, this was the GI Bill.
This was on the GI Bill.
On that. Right.
Otherwise, I don't know how I would have made it, but...
But this, plus your experience in the Navy teaching, gave you a second
thought. That's right. And even then, I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a teacher. I went through Mount Union in 3 years. I had to start from scratch, of course.
Sure.
I had no other choice. Went through Mount in 3 years, and at the end of the senior year, Professor Stonecipher, who was my major professor, suggested that I go to graduate school and go into the teaching profession. Now, the reason I got into accounting was simply that I was interested in accounting from the time I was in high school until I went back to college for the second time. And although I didn't start as a business or economics major, I started in Mount Union as a chemistry major.
Interesting.
And after the first year, I decided this wasn't for me. So I went into the business administration area and accounting in particular.
Well, let me back up just a moment. You said you were a tool and die maker. Where was this now, industry-wise?
A couple of different places. I was a tool and die maker primarily at the Alliance Manufacturing, where they make the Alliance tenor rotor
right.
and the garage door lifters and all that sort of thing. I also worked as a tool and die maker at the old airplane plant that used to be here in Alliance, where Armac is now.
The Taylor
Craft. Taylor Craft.
Taylor Craft, right.
And from there, then, I was went into the service.
Mm-hmm.
And after I came out of the service, I worked for Babcock and Wilcox. And
well, that was the Rush Street plant?
That was the Rush Street plant.
Right. Okay, now we're set. All right, so you came to Mount. As I recall, you weren't the only member of your family attending college at that time, isn't that right?
I guess that's right. My oldest son and I entered Mount Union together as freshmen, and he didn't finish right away. He went here for 2 years, and he wasn't sure just what area of endeavor he wanted to get into, so he decided to get his service out of the way and then come back and finish, which he did. And I think it was the better way for
right.
him. And then I had a younger son that came to Mount a little later on, and same thing happened to him. He wasn't sure, so he went to the Air Force for 4 years and then came back and finished.
Well, before, of course, you became identified as the faculty, that was the sort of recognition point or association I had for you, here is a father and son combination, which is pretty unique. You don't find that very often.
Well, that's right. At that time, it must have been very unique because we found out later that it was in the newspapers all over the United States, New York, Chicago, and all around.
Yeah.
So it must have been unique at that time, at any rate.
Now, you were in during the Veteran Bulge, weren't you?
Here. Yes, indeed. Life was quite different. I always felt sorry for the 18-year-olds that were in school at the same time that I was, because, believe me, the GIs made it rather miserable academic-wise for these youngsters that were just out of high school. Now, the GIs were here for a definite purpose, and they didn't take anything for granted. If the professor said something that they didn't quite agree with, they would take him on, and this was a very unique learning process, I think. I believe that I learned more during that period than I would have had I gone to school
out of the high school pattern. Right. Well, now we're sitting in an office, a private office that you have enjoyed and occupied here for a number of years. There wasn't an office like this in Chapin Hall when you went. There weren't the buildings on campus either.
That's right. First of all, let me just mention about the buildings.
All right.
There were very few buildings, in fact, here on campus. There was Elliott Hall, of course, and the Science Hall, Lamborn Hall. There was Miller Hall. There was East Hall and Chapman Hall and the old library and what we used to call White Hollow.
Right.
Since that time, I have seen so many changes in the campus. And I'll get to the East Hall a little later, but first of all, I just want to mention the buildings that have gone up since I've been on campus as a member of the faculty. We have about three dormitories that have gone up. There's Ketchum Hall for girls, McMaster Hall for girls, King Hall for girls, Cunningham Hall for boys, McCready Hall for boys, and in addition, we have a nice, beautiful athletic building, the Timken Building. We have a brand new administration building, Beagley Hall. We have Crandall Art Studio and the annex that has just been completed not long ago, and an addition to the library, which has enhanced the library no end. Rodman Playhouse was not here, and Cope Music Hall. All of these, old Hoover Price Student Center. All of these have come into being during my stay here. But getting back to East Hall, where we had our classrooms, it was in the basement, as you well know. And within 50 feet of the building, we had a railroad track.
Now, you say it was in the basement. Now, you identify it.
The East Hall.
Yeah, but you say it was in the basement.
Oh, that's where the department had their classrooms and offices.
All right.
And every hour, there would be a train go up the tracks, and we would have to stop and wait until that train went by before we could resume our teaching. And then for a while, on the main floor of East Hall, they had a girls' dormitory. And the girls would get pretty noisy every now and then, and we'd have to take a pole and pound on the ceiling to get them to quiet down. If they didn't quiet down, we simply had to go up and see what was going on and ask them please to keep quiet because we were trying to hold classes. Well, these are the conditions that we worked under down there. And how we really managed to do what we did and teach what we did with two persons, I've often wondered, because at the time we thought nothing of it, but now I don't know how we did it.
And of course, it'd be an impossibility now and in the minds of many people.
Right, because you see, one thing, at that time our department was only around 35 majors, 35 to 50 majors. Now we have somewhere between 290 and 310 majors. There we had two professors. Now we have five full-time and several part-time professors. But nevertheless, I don't know how we managed to get along, because we not only had our own majors, we had people from other areas And we had some night classes when we, where we had folks from the city come in and take some work.
Now, when you were a student, what was the department you decided to become an economics major? Stonecipher, was there anyone ahead of him, or you identify the department with him?
I identify the department with him. There was someone here before him. I think Tower, was it?
Ralph Tower, and then there was a Davis. I don't know whether you had experience with Davis or not.
No, I hadn't. He was here during my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left, and Stonecipher came in the middle of the year.
Right.
Came the second semester of, I think it was 1948, I believe that mm-hmm. was the year. And then I went to school that summer, and I was in his economics class that first summer that he taught. And that's where I got my introduction to the economics and business area. And that's where I stayed.
And who else was in the department, do you recall, at that time in economics, Stonecipher? Or did you have experience with any of the others?
The only one that was in the department when I first came as a student was Stonecipher.
Mm-hmm.
Then shortly after that, they got a gentleman from Canada, and I'm trying to recall his name, and I can't think what his name is, but they did acquire another person in the department, and he taught there for 2 or 3 years, and incidentally, that's where I learned most of my accounting was from him.
Was that Webb?
That was Walt, not
Jack.
Walter, but Jack Webb.
Jack Webb.
That's right.
Right.
And then after he left, they had another party that was in there for a couple of years, and they left him go, and then while I was still in graduate school, they contacted me and asked me if I would consider coming to Mount Union, and I wrestled with that for a while and finally decided, since this was my home and I liked the school, liked the people, I decided I would come. I had some other offers. The fact of the matter is, I could have stayed at the University of Tennessee at double the salary that I got when I came here.
But this is a pattern that runs with so many people who have come or identified with Mount Union. And as you say, there's something about a sense of loyalty or liking the place, and
right.
You select it. How did you happen to select Tennessee?
When I was a student here, I learned to know and enjoy the company of another fellow that was in the service. He had been in the Navy also, and he was a flyer, and so we did have something in common. His name was James Brown. I guess he... we always called him Jim. His real
right.
name was Erskine James Brown, but no one here ever called him Erskine, except his wife. But Jim and I went through school. Well, he was a native Tennessean from Knoxville. And when the time came to think about graduate school, excuse me, we thought about various places, and he thought, well, why don't we take a look at Tennessee? Because that was in his hometown. He said, it's a good school. So during Christmas break, he and I both went down to Tennessee and talked to the people down there, and I liked it, and they had a good program, and so that's where we decided to go. Stoney sort of would like for me to have gone to Harvard.
Now, you said Stoney, you refer
that,
to
Mr.
Stonecipher.
Right.
Just for the sake of the record.
Right.
Know.
Everybody knew him as Stoney
that's
here,
right.
But no one else outside the college that's might
right.
Know him by that. But at any rate, in talking with him, we decided that Tennessee was just as good, if not better, than Harvard was in the area that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, Stoney just simply said, well, he thought that Harvard was overrated. I'm not sure that he would have said that about Princeton.
Right, right, yes, or a little Presbyterian bias
right.
there. Yeah. Well, you got your degree and came back. Any comments about the administration at that time? Do you have any association Did you regard Dr. Ketchum as a little austere, removed, or did you find him personable?
Dr. Ketchum was a very, very fine gentleman, very knowledgeable, quite well educated. He was not one who was outgoing. He was rather reserved, and it was hard to get to know him too well. Now, this was not true of his wife.
Right.
But Dr. Ketchum was quite reserved, and although I enjoyed what association I did have with him, but
yes,
not nearly as much as I had with his successor, Dr. Bracy.
Right. Now, you came back in what year, Ray?
I came back 1951.
51. Of course, Dr. Ketchum passed away suddenly in 53.
That's right.
You knew him as a student and then as a faculty colleague. Right.
Then Dr. Bracy, of course, was an opposite. He was quite personable.
Right.
And outgoing. I got along very well with him. If I ever wanted anything that I couldn't get any other way, all I had to do was pick up the phone and talk to Dr. Bracy, and if it was within reason, I got it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I never asked him for anything that wasn't within reason.
It all depends on the asker's point of view, right?
I do hold one thing against Dr. Bracy, though. He appointed me as a college marshal, and I was stuck with that job for 9 years. And believe me, during those 9 years, the college marshal did everything. He was responsible for the programs, for proofreading them, for getting them printed, for getting the tickets and getting them distributed, for holding the rehearsals, for determining the seating, and making sure that everybody was in line in their proper places before the procession started. And all of these things were the responsibility of the college marshal. And
well,
it isn't quite that bad today. They've sort of split up the responsibilities.
Right. But I think, as Bill Morgan said, who had it before you for quite some time, you ought to be thankful with the lifestyle today. You don't have those headaches to put up with.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
It still was a different approach, a little more decorum and respect for the tradition.
Everything is different today.
Right.
We had changes on the campus, as I've just said, so far as buildings are concerned. But there's been changes in the student body as well.
Right.
We find a change in the lifestyles, a change in the dress. We have the Students' Bill of Rights, which means that in the old days, if you wanted to go into a student's room for something that you suspected, why, you just went in.
Right.
Today, you cannot do that.
Right.
You have to get the student's permission before you dare go into his room. And things of that nature, which have changed drastically since that time. I will say this, however, that during the period of the unrest at Kent State and other schools out west and so on, we had very little real serious problems. The only one that I know about, and I only know this by hearsay, I wasn't here at the time. I was at the college, but I wasn't on campus at the time this happened. They tell me that some of the dissidents at that time decided that they were going to come in and take over Chapman Hall. And so they got themselves a big timber and were going to come over early in the morning. Well, at that time, the dean of the college was DeBeau Freed. And he got wind of this somehow. I don't know how, but he got wind of it. And I guess when the students came up on the steps at the front of the building, DeBeau threw the doors open. And there he stood with the chief of police and a couple of officers with him. And he just, in a quiet voice that he had, just advised the students that it would be to their advantage to return where they came from. And so far as I know, this is a true story. And that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And we really had no more trouble after that.
Yes, there were, of course, as you say, there were some dissidents and there were some Frasers here, but fortunately, DeBeau and some others defused
the
situations.
Right, and he was able to do that. He was quite capable.
Yes, very much so. Well, you wore the hat of college marshal. You also wore another hat in addition to accounting, and you can tell about how you got into that area.
Well, during the 60s, We know that computers were just beginning to come into a lot of use in
right.
the colleges. We had none. And Dr. Rodman, Dr. James Rodman, and Professor Stonecipher and I happened to go to a meeting at Ohio Bell in Cleveland one night. And on the way home, we began to discuss these things, and it got to the subject of computers. And during the process, Jim and I decided, well, let's try to do something about it here at Mount Union. So the two of us together, bearded Ernie Sheets, who was at that time in a position to do us some good, we started looking around and getting prices and so on. Well, it took us several years before we were able to convince the administration that they should spend some money to get the computer on campus. I'm not going to a long, drawn-out process, but it started with Dr. Bracey, and then when Dr. Bracey left, Dr. Weber. And Dr. Weber was the one who finally gave the go-ahead, and we got the computer center started. And Dr. Rodman then was the director of the center, and I was the operations manager, and I spent several years as the operations manager until Dean Freed decided that the department that I had left, well, I didn't leave it, really. I still insisted when they wanted to make me operations manager of the computer center, I insisted on keeping my faculty status and teaching at least one course, which I did. So I never really was away from the faculty.
Now this would be accounting that you were teaching.
That's right. I was teaching accounting, and I've had quite a varied experience as far as teaching is concerned because, you can judge for yourself. When I was, before I was in the computer center, I taught two courses in elementary accounting, two courses in intermediate accounting, one course in cost accounting, one in auditing, one in federal income tax, one in business law, one in marketing, one in advertising, and during the summer I taught some economics, and then I taught a course in labor relations. So you see that my teaching experience has been quite varied.
And it's certainly spread out.
It sure was. But at any rate, Dean Freed, getting back to that story, decided that they needed some maturity and stability in the business department. He asked me if I would come back teaching full-time and leave the computer center. Well, really, he didn't know this, but I was just champing at the bit to get back into the teaching area, and I didn't let him know at the time that I was anxious to come back. So he called me in and proposed this, and I told him yes, I would consider going back, consider if I were to maintain my salary and also get the increments that the faculty were to get that spring, and which was agreed upon.
And you've been teaching then primarily accounting since that time.
Right. Since that time, it's been all accounting except for two courses. I taught one in business law and one in labor relations. Mm-hmm. But other than that, the rest has been all accounting since that time.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I've enjoyed my life here at the college. I never would teach in a large university. This is one of the reasons why I came to Mount Union instead of staying at Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about jealousies in various professions. Well, it's not that way at Mount Union that I know of, at any rate. And if I, in 26 years, I probably would know about it. But at the University of Tennessee or any other large university, you better keep your back to the wall, because if you don't, someone's going to stick a knife in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that kind of a situation. And I could not operate efficiently in that kind of atmosphere. So,
of course, I suppose really at Tennessee or the larger universities, the entire department is the size of the faculty here.
Yes.
And it's a lot of competition.
Yes.
Just within that one little or department.
You have no idea.
Right.
Yes, indeed. Though I'm still on good terms with them at Tennessee. I see some of the professors every now and then when I go to the American Accounting Association meetings. And we're good friends, but no way would I teach there or any other large university.
Well, now, you've done some consulting or work outside, too,
oh, yes.
Haven't you, Ray?
Yes, I've kept my practical experience going by doing some consulting and some tax work, and primarily tax work and statements and so on for various places. So I'll probably continue doing some of that, but not as much as I have in the past.
We have a consultant or a practitioner in the community who does this sort of thing, but he writes open letters to the paper. I've never noticed any letters from you in that respect.
You're not going to.
All right. Well, over the years, I've always kidded Ray about politics and about being Mr. Democrat, and of course, Ray is a good Republican in the best sense, but not the arch conservative that this man I referred to is.
I hope not.
Yeah.
Certainly wouldn't want to be.
What about personnel in the economics department? Are there any that you want to comment on that you have seen come and go in this respect?
I think we probably have the best faculty now that we've ever had. As is the case in all departments, you've had some good ones, you've had some that weren't so good.
Right.
But at the moment, now I'm just speaking academically.
Right.
We have four beside myself, and
yes.
I'm not including myself in
right.
this, but four very fine teachers and people. So far as I know, there is widespread cooperation within the department. When anyone is asked to do something, no one refuses. They do it willingly and cheerfully. And we have one girl at the present time that's in the department that is a horse for work. I never saw anything like it. She is willing to do anything at any time and even offers beyond that to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And while she's teaching and doing these other things, she's also working on her doctorate at Kent State. And how she does all this, mm-hmm. I don't know. It makes me tired just to think about all the things she's doing.
But I would agree in that assessment, and I think probably the overall competence, as you say, is probably better. You have people in various areas to meet the classroom situation better now than probably at any time.
Yes, we have, for example, we have two people in accounting. That's Mr. Penny, who's head of the department,
right.
And myself. And we have Jim Beery and Pat Foley that are in business administration,
mm-hmm.
that is finance and marketing
right.
and all the rest of it. And then we have Dr. Schimming and Dr.
Phillips,
yes, yeah. I couldn't mm-hmm. think of his name, in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a well spread out area of concentration.
And, of course, you can call in some part-time people, too, can't
oh, yes,
you, for
yes.
spatial
and
lives.
We do. We have to because yes. the number of courses that we have to teach now.
Right.
We just can't handle all ourselves, mm-hmm. so we have extra people that teach one or two courses mm-hmm. now and then. And even so, we do not have enough faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hopeful that in the very near future they'll be able to add another one to the faculty mm-hmm. other than my replacement.
Yes.
And this is a possibility that may happen in the next year or two.
Are there any other individuals that stand out either in your student days or after you came back, personality-wise, just colorful individuals?
Well, of course, other than Professor Stonecipher, who, of course, I just can't say enough about him.
Right.
He helped me in so many ways, and I learned so much from him. But other than that, Dr. Eric and Mary Eckler, were two that had a great impression on me and that I enjoyed very, very much. We had a professor in psychology that impressed me in many ways, not only academically but otherwise. He's now at the Arizona State University. There's Dr. Craig Rover.
Yes.
And he was really a character, any way you want to look at it. But a very fine guy. And I learned a lot from him and enjoyed being with him socially.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Webb, who taught accounting, I enjoyed very much. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Morgan, who was in chemistry. And I'm sure that there are many others that I was quite impressed with at the time, but those are the ones that
stand out
in my memory.
Right. Any incidents that you recall particularly? What about the office you had at East Hall as contrasted to your quarters now?
Well, the office at East Hall, that was something else. We had an office that I'm sure wasn't more than 8 feet square. And in that office we had not only files, but we had four desks, and if any other
seven, eight, nine.
Yes, as I said, if we had to talk to someone during regular hours, we would have to ask whoever was in there if they'd mind stepping out for a little bit, which we didn't like to do, of course.
Of course, the counterpart of that was Old Chapman Hall, and you remember where the reading room of the library had been when you were a student, and maybe, well, when you were a student. Because when you came back, we had the new library.
Right.
But in your student days, that was the reading room, and then they made that into faculty offices, which was just simply some partitions,
right,
not
I
to the ceiling.
That. Right.
And there was one member of the faculty, Paul Chapman, tells that he would be advising a girl to take a course, and this person would come charging over and say, no, no, tell her to take it. So he had a lot of extra advice. You had the advantage, you could get everybody out and not have that.
That's right. But we managed and got along very well. Usually if we wanted to talk privately with someone, we would make an appointment away from the office. Mm-hmm. So that we didn't interfere with other members of the faculty and their students.
The thing that always it sort of stuck in my mind about that place was the absence of windows.
Yes.
If you had claustrophobia, you couldn't stay in that place.
There were only two small windows on the west side of the one classroom, and I think just one or so on the east side.
Right.
And that was it. However, in the other room, there were three sides that had no windows at all, and then one side, it was practically all windows.
Right.
But if you remember, if you had a class, and that's where all my classes were held, in that particular room, you had to go out through the other classroom to get outside.
Right.
And I was always apprehensive of that, because if anything should have happened in that other classroom, we would have been penned in and had to have broken the windows and got out through the windows. So I suggested to the powers that be in the administration that they convert a garage door that was there. You know, this was supposed originally to have been a garage.
Right.
And there was a garage door there, but you couldn't lift it. So I suggested they cut a door into it. And certain people in the administration said, oh no, couldn't do that. And so this was one time when I did go to Dr. Bracey and explained the situation to him. He says, you'll have it. And within 2 days, I had it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that that was a necessary thing, because it could have caused some problems if some calamity.
Now, was the maintenance in the north end while you were
That's
there?
Right. That's right. And every once in a while, we had to put up with the noise in there as well.
Right. Of course, Mr. Sopp was
yes.
in charge at that
yes.
time. Was Mr. Mosley when you came?
Mr. Mosley was there when I came, and then Mr. Sopp came after him, and then, of course, our present
right.
man is.
So it was kind of a three-ring circus with the train and the girls and maintenance and other inconveniences. Well, one of the other traditions we're talking about, I think Dr. Bracey coined the phrase transition from tradition, and it, I suppose, concerns some of us who can remember when Chapman Hall had girls going up one side of the stairs and the men up the other side of the stairs.
That's the way it was when I was a student.
Right, but there used to be another tradition. At about 10 o'clock in the morning, everything stopped for a coffee break.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Now, you sometimes had your coffee in your office, but many of us went over to the diner.
Yes, and before that, there was a place at the corner of Union and State, which they called the College Inn.
Right.
And faculty and students would flock over there during the 10 o'clock hour, and it was really an enjoyable time. And then, of course, that went out of business, and then they had the diner on State Street that the faculty went to. Not many students came there, yes, but the faculty would go over there for their 10 o'clock coffee. And in between those two periods, they had a snack bar down in the basement of Miller Hall.
Right.
And we would go over there and have our coffee. The fact of the matter is, a couple of enterprising students took over the coffee concession, so to speak, and they made up coffee cups for each of the professors and put their first initial and their last name on the coffee cup. And I still have mine.
Do you have yours?
And I often look at that, and every time I look at it, I remember those fellows that had that concession.
Some people, of course, feel that maybe it was an undue waste of some time, and yet it's kind of like the British influence, and I always felt there was comradeship and a fellowship with both faculty and students.
That is exactly right. I was very sorry to see those times end, because they had a great value. You not only got to know your colleagues, but during those times you could talk about mutual problems, mm-hmm, and many times find solutions to them without having to go through a lot of red tape by way of the administration and faculty meetings and so on. And then, of course, as you mentioned, you had a camaraderie with the students, and we just don't have that anymore. The students seem to go their way and click together for their coffee or whatever, and faculty don't get together for coffee anymore.
Well, of course,
they
there were.
They do have a Wednesday dinner meeting.
Right. Of course, in those years, there were not the office appointments that you presently have, and so it was a relief to get out of wherever you were, I suppose, and do that. But apparently each year things move at a little more rapid rate or something, and we just get away from it.
You know, when you have 60 or more advisees, mm-hmm, now I'm talking about each professor.
Yes.
That means that you're pretty well tied up.
Right.
And you haven't the opportunity to get together with other people the way you used to have when there were a lot fewer people.
This is true. Now, I can recall in the coffee breaks like that, of course, it was always a lot of fun to joyish or joke with someone, and Stoney was always someone that we liked to take it out on for his conservative approach, and I can recall on three or four different occasions I wanted a student to go into his blackboard before class and write in great big letters, John Maynard Keynes is the king, and put a big exclamation mark, and the students all said, but I want to pass the course.
However, someone, I wouldn't say who, have put things of that nature on the board just to needle him. And Stoney was very serious sometimes about some things, and particularly with certain members of the faculty that I'll not mention by name. But they would make statements that would just cause Stoney's blood pressure to go up to 500. And he would just almost sputter. And he was very serious about his economic theories and
yes, he was.
Financial theories.
Let's just say he was a man of great integrity and commanded a lot of respect.
Wonderful man.
From both students and faculty. And that. Well, you saw some deans come and go, too, during this time. You came in when... Was Melvin Hyde still dean?
That's right. Melvin Hyde was here when I came in as a student. And then when I came back as a faculty member, Dr. Wesley was the dean.
Right.
And, of course, when Dr. Ketchum passed away, Dr. Wesley became acting president for a while.
Right.
And then after Dr. Bracey came in, Dr. Wesley left to become dean at another institution, and we had Dr. Francis Christie.
Right.
And then he was here for a few years, and then we had another dean, Dr. Bernie Gross.
Right.
And then when Dr. Bernie Gross left, we had Dr. William Morgan as acting dean until they got Dr. DeVoe Freed as a dean. And then when he became president of another institution, Dr. Truman Turnquist became acting dean. And then we got our present dean, who is Dr. Ben Lance. So you see, really, I've worked under seven different deans. Dr. Ketchum, Dr. Wesley is the acting president, Dr. Bracey and Dr. Weber. That's four in the presidency. So I've seen people come and go in administration as well as in the faculty.
Right. Well, as an old sergeant used to say in the service, you know, he said, look at these hash marks I got on my sleeve. If you stay around long enough, you see that flow and the coming and going like that. What about the socially? You have gone with faculty, or though being in town, you have friends in the community too.
Oh yes. After all, I came to Alliance with my parents, of course, when I was 5 years old. That was in 1914. And of course, through the years, we have many friends and acquaintances in the city. And we have many friends that have been and are on the faculty.
Right.
And we've had a very nice social life, not only with faculty, but with students. We used to, of course, as you well know, serve as, not policemen, but simply as guests of the various organizations on campus to sort of lend our selves as ways of keeping them straight, which I'm sure didn't have a bit of influence.
All right.
But nevertheless, it was a good social time. And I always hated to see those times go, because you didn't have a certain rapport with the students then that you don't have today.
Right.
Now, the students today are fine people in the main. And we have a good rapport with them, but not in a social sense that we used to have.
Yes, I noticed that at the library. I recognize many, many students on campus just by recognition, but I don't place the name. And of course, in former years, I used to work more at the desk, so you'd get to know them. But even then, I think you knew more about students. We're aware of more of their problems. And today, it seems to me, it's a more casual relationship. Now, you were a member of a fraternity when you were on campus, Ray.
Yes, I was a member of the Phi Kappa Tau fraternity down on South Union.
And of course, those days have changed, too, the position of the fraternity and sorority on campus.
Really, I have, in recent years, have had practically no relationship with the fraternities, you know, and they did away with the house mothers and house fathers, and they still have officially an advisor, but he has little or no influence or say with the fraternities, and so they're pretty much on their own and keep pretty much to themselves. They don't ask the faculty in for dinners like they used to, you know, or right. anything of that nature.
You were a faculty advisor for a while, weren't
yes.
you?
At a very difficult time, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, they had some problems with certain persons who put crosses on
right.
and burned them on lawns of the colored.
But this was before the intensive period of the
oh, yes.
60s. This
oh,
was
yes.
much earlier, but
much
that
earlier.
Was bad enough at that time.
Oh, yes.
Right.
And, of course, I sat in on all of that difficult negotiations with the guilty students and the administration and so on.
And, now, years ago, before your association here, and you will remember the name, of course, of President McMaster.
Oh, yes.
But President McMaster used to have a phrase. He talked about the happy family. And he was speaking of the whole college community. And, of course, there were, in those days even, some who liked to poke fun at this concept. And yet, it's when you analyze, it was a good, basic, wholesome concept to have.
That's right.
And there, as you point out, there was much more, I think, closer relationship between students and faculty, and even faculty and administration. And this we have seen just sort of dissipate over the years.
That's correct. Dr. Ketchum carried on that family tradition.
Yes.
And then Dr. Bracey did to some extent, but during the years it has gradually eroded.
Right. Well, I think that phrase, and I don't know whether it was original with Bracey or not, but he called it transition from tradition. And the question is where no one just seems to be able to assess quite where we are at the present time. We just know it's a different lifestyle.
That's right. Although, in particular, in relation to the students, I see this coming full circle.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in the dress, for example, that it's beginning to come back to what it was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The girls are dressing up considerably as to compared to what they were 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Right.
Even the boys are beginning to change their style of clothing and hair and everything else. And also the respect, I think, mm-hmm. is coming back gradually. I know that there's more respect toward the faculty today than there was 5, 6 years ago.
Right.
And so I think, as in all things, they tend to go full circle,
right.
Given enough time.
Sometimes you think it's kind of wearisome going through it, and I suppose students would have the same complaint.
Sure.
They have their... I mentioned the other day I didn't think there were the characters on the faculty, the colorful individuals that there were when I was in school with Dr. Hedlund and some individuals like that, and some of the students sort of smiled. And I guess they're still characters on the faculty.
At least they think so.
They think so, right. It depends on the definition.
Right.
Any other incidents that happened, Ray, that you that stand out, that you think of particularly in your association here?
Oh, I don't know. As really, I've led a rather quiet life here on the campus. I haven't had too many incidents with which I was concerned, at any rate. And I think probably one of the things that I'm most proud of is the reputation that our graduates have made when they left here,
mm-hmm.
and which is reflected in our department and in our school. As you know, I said a while ago, we have about 300 majors, which
right.
is the largest department on the campus. And even back when we only had 35, 40 majors, we had companies knocking at our door for our graduates. Ohio Bell took an awful lot of our graduates, as did Goodrich and Goodyear,
mm-hmm.
and a number of others.
Timken did.
Timken, and yes. Timken still does.
Yes.
They think very, very highly of Mount Union graduates, and in recent years we've been placing a lot of students in public accounting, and it's amazing how many Mount Union graduates are working for Ernst & Ernst, which is an international accounting firm, as well as many and other accounting firms scattered throughout the area and the country. So that I guess I'm most proud of my graduates.
Yes. Well, I think that's fine.
That's at good. Least I've had some small part in their education and in their success. And we do have some very, very successful graduates.
I think this is true in that area. I think they have been. And well, I think that's a good note to close the interview on. It's been interesting to go back over a quarter century or more and reflect a bit and close with this thought that, after all, that's why we're here, to provide these students with some sort of background and expertise. And when they turn out well, you appreciate that.
I certainly do.
Well, thank you very much.
It's been a joy to me upon my retirement to have so many students come in and tell me that they have enjoyed my courses and that they've learned good many things from them. And I guess this is part of your pay.
Well, I think this is true. It doesn't buy the bread, but no check can give you that kind of feeling.
That's correct. Good.
Well, we hope we'll see you off and on the campus again, Ray, in spite of the fact you're retired, and I know you will with your interest in the college.
Oh, I'll be around.
Very good. Thank you.